Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. We're at the end of the second week of this year's Tour de France, the second rest day, which is just time for us and the riders to catch our breaths before the final week and the showdown in the Alps. More than any tour for years, this has been a tour for the climbers. And so it's a great pleasure to welcome to the Bike Show for this rest day review a man whose knowledge of cycling's great ups and downs is deeper than almost anyone outside the professional peloton. His name is Simon Warren, and he is an accomplished amateur racing cyclist and author of the 100 Greatest Climbs series of pocket-sized books about, you've guessed it, cycling hill climbs. He began with two guides to the UK, then won two climbs in Belgium and another on the climbs of the Tour de France. His latest book, out now, is a regional guide to the greatest cycling climbs in southeast England. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
As a lover of hill climbing, was this a tour that, I mean, there's always lots of climbs in the tour, but was this a tour that particularly whetted your appetite? Because people have said that it is a tour for the climbers. Would you agree with that?
I think it's more a tour for the climbers in the sense that there isn't a long solo time trial. I think That's what's tipped the balance towards the climbers. It's got more mountaintop finishes than practically any tour I can remember. But I think that's more the trend of the Grand Tours. They like to make these showcase finishes. It's great for the viewers. It's not so great for the riders. It could have had an extra day in the Pyrenees. I don't know. It's probably a bit heavy on the Alps.
And what about these little climbs? I mean, I say little, but they're not the great mountain ranges, but they're little pimples that appear in Brittany or somewhere in Holland and the Ardennes, Belgium.
Yes.
I mean, what do you make? Do you enjoy those? Because that's really your territory, at least where you come from in terms of your books. It's those kind of climbs that is what we have in Britain rather than the kind of 25-minute, 40-minute monsters.
When I wrote the two British books, and then I was looking for the next avenue, and I thought, right, Belgium, you know, look at the climbs in the Belgian races. They're all very similar length. I can document them, package them in the same sort of, the same product, and they were perfect for it. So, stage, I think it was 2 or 3 that finished up the Murderhoy. I mean, it is a little blip, but it has that tension and that bit of drama at the end of the stage. I mean, no one's going to lose the race there. There should be tiny gaps, but I think some of the gaps were bigger than some people thought. It also gives specialists who can't climb a mountain but have that huge explosive power the chance to win a stage, and it's a variety we're seeing in the tour that we haven't seen before. And I think the tour gets a lot of their ideas from other races. I think the Vuelta and the Giro have been more innovative, where the tour's been a lot more traditional, but they're seeing the innovations the other races are making and thinking, right, we'll have some of that. And that first week was every day was different. Okay, that kaleidoscope of race, different types of racing's out of the way. Now we're going to fly down to the Pyrenees and get back to what we know, in a sense.
So from a racing point of view, over the last couple of weeks, what have you enjoyed most?
Let me think. I did like the stage to the Murderhoy. The cobbles, that was a nervous stage. You're sort of watching that. Half of you want someone to crash and you want to see a lot of blood. The other half says, no, I don't want that to happen because I want to see them all duking it out in the mountains. You know, I was sitting, I was ready to see that first mountaintop finish. That is always, is the one moment in the cycling calendar. Every single thing leads up to it and everything else that follows sort of happens as a consequence of it. It's that one first mountaintop finish. That's what I wanted to see. And I wanted to see 5 guys toe-to-toe swapping the lead, but we didn't quite get that. I'd have liked to see Quintana up there. I would have thought they'd be very close. But, that first climb, Quintana missed the tour last year. Contador was coming into it this year. Everyone was here, all the contenders. And Froome just span away from them. And it was like, oh.
Do you feel a bit, not exactly let down, but underwhelmed? Or are you really...
Slightly deflated.
Deflated.
Because we want to see... Yeah, we want to see 1989 all over again. We want to see the lead swapping places. We want to see people getting tired and having to come back. We don't want to see the dominance of one rider, but, there's one guy there who's physiologically, whatever, better than everyone else. And, at the moment, he's cruising.
And have you enjoyed watching his dominant performance as, one climber to another?
Well, everyone likes to see a man go up the hill fast. I don't know. I'm not the biggest Chris Froome fan. I don't dislike the guy or anything. There's something about him doesn't, I'm a massive Wiggo fan. I loved seeing Wigo climb the mountains. I loved seeing him suffer. And I don't know, something about the way Chris Froome does it, it always seems too easy. Does that make sense?
Well, you feel like he's always got an extra gear that he can slip into.
Yeah, I think he runs a very small compact. He must be able to, anyone who can spin a gear that big, it's probably 34 at the front, 34 at the back. Well, that's what it appears to be. But no, yeah, hats off to him. He's nailed it.
Do you identify with the kind of diesel type climber? Because, you know, Nairo Quintana is that sort of a rider rather than the fast, explosive.
You're asking climbing. Me who I picture myself as when I'm climbing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to be Contador. I like to be out the saddle. You know, I can't lie. There's a couple of times up mountains when I've been out the saddle, shaking the bike side to side, you know, almost doing my Contador impression, mimicking him. It's that sort of, I think he has a lot of energy. And having seen him on the road, we went to the Vuelta last year and saw him come past. And it's something electrifying about the way he climbs. And he's been subdued this Tour de France. Everyone says the Giro Tour double was going to be too hard, and it looks like it is, because he's been 5% below where he should be. He hasn't had any of that explosion. Contador's my man.
How about Joaquin Rodriguez? I really enjoyed watching him solo to victory in the Pyrenees, because he looked like he was really giving everything. That's what I like to see, is a rider who I feel like they're really emptying themselves.
I mean, Rodriguez's face looked like we feel when we're climbing mountains. That's what it looks like if you looked at his face. And you cut to Quintana and he's there on the phone to his teammate and eating a sandwich. It's like, that isn't right. You know, you should look like Rodriguez. He was killing himself. You know, he was just going to crawl over that line and collapse. And it's great. But, you know, if it was a level playing field like it was in the first mountaintop finish, he wouldn't take the pace. He was allowed his chance to take the stage, and he very bravely went and did it. But Sky, I've got this race dialed down, and no one is going to get away unless they let them get away.
Let's look forward to the week ahead. I mean, there was that time when Geraint Thomas was really called upon to help out Chris Froome, and then Chris Froome, it looked like he was having a bit of a sudden rush of blood to the head, because he attacked his own teammate and went solo, and then there was a real problem of like, okay, maybe if he gets counterattacked, he won't be able to follow, and then we'll see something happening.
It's only for a brief. It wasn't like when Froome dropped Wigo a couple of years ago. This was only for a few hundred meters, I think, and then it sort of all came back together again.
But it was a bit of a strange thing to do. And and my sense is that Chris Froome doesn't have the greatest tactical brain on his cycling head. I mean, he's tremendously, he's physiologically, as we've said, you know, ahead of everybody else in this tour. But it does seem to do a few strange things.
Well, that's because he's always looking at the floor and not looking around to see what else anyone's doing. So, you know, there could be 20 metres in between him looking at the floor and looking up and realising Contador's attacked. I mean, that's a bit damning. But he is very much in his own little world, it seems. He's very well-known, awkward riding style. So maybe things can happen without him instantly noticing. But there's not been a moment I've seen where he has looked remotely in trouble.
It doesn't look like he's had a bad day.
No,
I mean, they say that every Tour winner does have a bad day. And that has not happened yet.
I mean, what we didn't expect was Froome to have such a big lead when we got to that first mountain stage, because they picked up time in the team time trial. They picked up bits here and there of everyone. Everyone had a little bit of bad luck or misfortune apart from Froome and Sky. They just sailed through it. And it surprised even them, I'm sure. You know, so they had this buffer when they got to the mountains, and then Froome attacked and made it big, and everyone think, oh no, he's got 3 minutes. But as someone pointed out, he's only got a minute and something off Quintana up the first mountain. The rest of it was gained earlier on in the race. It was a slightly less superhuman performance than some people originally said it was.
And what's your take on the way that Sky and I guess whoever else is, you know, the big, strong, big money teams, and the way that they approach the mountains, which is to go really hard in the run-in and then kind of use their strong riders as almost cannon fodder to burn everybody else off in a sort of cycling battle of attrition, where it's like, well, we've got five really strong guys.
Exactly.
You've got three really strong guys. That means we've got two ahead of you and we're going to win.
It seems a bit greedy, doesn't it? You know, I look at things like Thomas. I think, what could Thomas do if he was leading a team, if we were let him run wild? I mean, I see Greg Thomas as the successor in our hearts to Wigo. you know, if anyone could inherit, you know, Wigo's place and, you know, where we see him, it's Thomas. We want him to be leading the Grand Tour and attacking these stages. But he's just, you know, he's just one of the henchmen for Froome. And then you've got Port and Koenig. And yeah, these guys could all lead teams.
Well, I think Port will be, won't he?
Yeah, well, he's going to BMC, which, you know, he's not going to be good news to Van Garderen, who spent all this time waiting for Cadel Evans to lead. He gets a couple of years on his own, and then another Australian comes and makes him number two. But, you know, Van Garderen's had his chance to step up, and he's fallen short. So let's see what Port can do. But yeah, they have an embarrassment of riches who they can use to just nail it from stage one. I mean, gone are the days where Claudio Chiappucci can go from the gun, a great climber, and just climb mountain after mountain on his own, eating them up. It doesn't happen like that. It's controlled. No one gets away who isn't supposed to get away. And they'll drill it on the front, killing everyone, you know, who can't hold the pace, and then they'll deliver their man to the final, who'll romp up it and win. It seems very controlled. I mean, US Postal started it. They set that template. It's disappeared a bit for a while, but it seems to be back with Sky. Not that I want to draw any comparisons between the two.
And do you think that Team Sky are just really good at picking the best riders and have got the deepest pockets to pay them? Or have they got training methods that are superior to other teams? I mean, who was it? I think David Walsh, the famous journalist for the Sunday Times, who played a role in the downfall of Lance Armstrong, saying that other teams were hopeless and amateur by comparison with what Sky are doing. Is that true, or is that unfair? Which is it? Is it better, more talent, or better training?
Well, if we start with picking the team, it's like, how can Real Madrid can pick all these great players? Well, because they've got the deepest pockets. You know, they'll probably pay Richie Port more to be Froome's lieutenant than he'll get paid to lead another team, you know, I'm guessing. You know, looking at their training methods, you know, their whole thing has come from this BC thing of marginal gains. And when they first started and they started winning races, you know, I'm 100% behind this. You know, the other teams, the other guys, they just doped and then they went to the pub at the weekends. Team Sky, they drilled it and they trained and they did everything right. And then they started winning and everyone's going, oh, wait a minute, you know, we can't dope anymore. All that's in the past. So we're going to have to start training like they train. And, they, you know, they've been ahead of that curve. Everyone's going to catch up with that curve. So what's going to keep them ahead of everyone else? I mean, how many more intervals can you do? How many more mountains can you climb? How much more weight can you lose before it's a level playing field across the board? And then does it come down to the talent they've bought? Are these the best riders in the world? But then it starts to get very awkward when you start to suspect people's training methods. You know, it's just riding the bike.
Well, you say it's just riding the bike, and a lot of us now ride the bike with all kinds of computers strapped on, measuring everything and uploading it to Strava and saving it and telling us what our heart rate is and that kind of stuff. During this past week, we have seen this video from a couple of years ago of Froome's climb of the Mont Ventoux in 2013 when he won the Tour for the first time, and with a sort of annotation of the real-time data that was being recorded about his heart rate, his speed, his cadence, and his power output. Did you have a look at that?
I'm all over Twitter, so I saw it as soon as it was up, and I looked at it, and it's a good bit of, I don't know, Twitter fodder.
Did it make you feel like these guys are in a different realm of fitness?
When I saw it happen, I said, no one could spin that fast. I mean, you know, I'm no elite athlete, but you get yourself in a climb, then you suddenly accelerate that fast. You'd die a thousand deaths. He'd have spanned that fast, and he just kept going. And, you know, for me, that seems just weird.
And what about the heart rate not peaking above 160?
I mean, everyone's heart rate's different.
That's true.
So they say. Mine peaks up right up there at 200. But, yeah, the Ray Froome's only went from, you know, 153 to, you know, what is it, to 155. But, again, and they say they hacked this data from Sky and it's the real data, but there's so many other parameters that could have got in the way. Maybe there's too much sweat on his heart rate monitor. Maybe there's a bit of wind. It's not an exact science. It's far from an exact science. And although if you're looking at it, if you're being sceptical and cynical, and I'm both of those, you know, you say, oh, look, this is obviously cheating, but it's no hard fact. It's, you know, it's just, again, it's just guessing.
Do you think that this sort of data is a good thing to have at the tour? Would you like to see official telemetrics during the stage?
I want it all banned. I want to ban power meters, heart rate monitors, the lot of it. Chuck it all in the bin. I mean, we don't want scientists turning our sport into a game of numbers. You know, the sport's about looking in your opponent's eye and attacking them. You know, when a rider crests a hill, you don't think, oh, I wonder how many watts he was putting out up there or what his heart rate was. I mean, it's boring. And people are sending me links to various scientist websites where they've dissected every single pedal stroke and made graphs and charts of it. We're not interested in that. We want to see, you know, to quote Phil Sherwin or whatever, mano-a-mano attacking on the hill. Don't, you know, take our sport and turn it into a science experiment.
So would you like to see that taken off the riders full stop?
Yeah, so they can't use it. I mean, let them have the Garmin so they can get the Strava KOMs at the end of the day. But just, you know, take all that data away from them. So they're riding on feeling and instinct. Let's make it natural and real again and not, you know, some sort of computer game that's been planned in the lab 3 months earlier and is just executed on the mountain.
Oh, that's a very harsh way of looking at it, because no matter how much planning you do before, you've actually got to turn out on the day and deliver the goods, haven't you, really?
Well, yeah, you do. But, you know, where Sky have excelled is when everything goes right and they can deliver the goods. Obviously, when they've not excelled as much as when there's been more chance of things going wrong. I could bring up Wiggo's failure to win Roubaix, but, you know, there's so many things that can go on with that. He had a great shot at it, and I won't knock him for anything he's done.
So enough of the pros, at least for the minute. Let's talk about how we can enjoy riding the climbs of this year's tour as an amateur racing cyclist such as yourself, or as a cycle tourist, which is kind of my way of approaching these things. Which of the climbs that we've seen and that we're going to see in the third week of the tour do you rate as destinations?
I think of the ones so far in the Pyrenees, if I was to pick one of those, obviously the Tourmalet. I prefer it from the other side, so the side they descended. That's a longer climb. Is it from Barrages?
Oh, yeah, Barrage, I think.
Barrage, that's it. My pronunciation of
French. And that's got the long switchbacks.
Yes, that's the best. I mean, and that is fantastic. It can be 30 degrees in the base and it can be snowing at the top. You've got summer and winter in one day and amazing science scenery. And the summit is, you know, not all summits are the same, but this one is it's a knife edge. It just goes up and then it drops straight back down the other side. There's a couple of restaurants, you know, hidden in the clouds, and that's it. It's amazing. So if you have to ride one mountain in the Pyrenees, you make it that one.
I remember doing that one a few years ago as a cycle tourist and chatting at the bottom or in Barrage, I think, with a guy who was on a racing bike, and I was sitting there cooking up some stew on the town square on my on my Trancher, and I was getting chatting to him, and he was talking about how he was really excited to be riding these mountains, and he was riding them with the gears that he said that the professionals would ride them in. So I think he had a 39-25. Does that sound about right?
Maybe a 27. Yeah.
And I was sort of very impressed, you know, there with my triple and my massive sprocket on the back. But about halfway to three quarters of the way up, I actually passed him because he was no longer cycling his bike at that point.
Oh my goodness!
And I was there with my front and back panniers spinning like Chris Froome, but at about a tenth of the speed of Chris Froome. But I did make it up, and I can vouch for the bowl of stew in the cafe at the top because it was absolutely freezing. I had to put on all my clothes and then dive into the cafe because there was a bit of snow and it was midsummer. Oh, but wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I didn't see much of the view from the top. That's always a shame with these things, isn't it?
I did the Pyrenees in, I think it was 8 days. Me and my dad went down so he could help with the driving. We did five mountains a day, west to east. And there's one, Luzon de Den, which is one I remember Le Monde attacking on in 90. And I was desperate to see those bends at the top, but 5K to go, I could barely see my handlebars. It was that foggy. And then a couple of hours later, up the next climb, as bright as day. So, you know, and this was September. The two previous trips to the Pyrenees had been washed out because of heavy snowfall in May and early June. So it is potluck whether you're going to get the views. But sometimes it's better to have a bit of cloud because that protects you from 30-degree heat.
And so when you're doing this, all this research for these books, because it must be said that you have ridden every single climb that is in all of your books, and you have to ride it, and you write about your experience of riding it. I've seen you attack a climb at the Catford Hill climb, and you don't attack them all like that, do you? I mean, are you sort of looking around the place and sort of making mental notes, or are you really giving it everything you got?
Because of the advent of Strava, you don't go all the way to the Pyrenees without wanting to put some rubber down and leave your mark on the leaderboard. And you can't ride I can't ride five climbs a day at full gas, but I'd pick a couple where I'd give it everything. I'd make the notes mentally. And often if I left the car at the bottom, I could go up, because often you don't want to take pictures on the way up, because you'll get to the first hairpin bend and go, wow, that's amazing, take a picture. Then 100 metres later, wow, that's amazing, take a picture. And you'll never get there. So you ride up, you take it all in, then I get my dictaphone out, splurge out whatever's come to my mind, and then on the way down, I'll have recognised a few good points and then take the pictures. So in that case, you tick all the boxes. You get to give a massive effort on the climb. You know, it's all training, remember? And then you sort of experience it as, you know, a rider would experience it. Then on the way back down, you do all your documenting, back to the car, move on. Although I have been criticised for driving between them, but in 8 days, I just couldn't do any other way.
And so looking ahead to the Alps, what's interesting about the Alps in terms of the climbs that they're putting in? Aren't they putting in a new climb, this sort of spaghetti strewn on the side of the mountain?
Yeah, which I rode 2 weekends ago now. I went to ride the Marmotte, which is the classic sportif, which has, for 35 years, it was the blueprint for sportifs, and it's still one of the hardest out there, where you start in Bourg d'Oisans, you go over the Col de Glandon, round through the valley, over the Col de Telegraph, the Glibier, and finish up at Duez. It's 175K, and it breaks you every time. But there's been a problem on the road from the top of the Col de Lautre back to Bourg d'Oisans, which is an integral part of the route, and a tunnel's collapsed, and there's been a landslide. And that road's been cut out for months now. You know, it's split communities in half. It's almost like they've put a huge wall up. People have been bussed around on the lake, so they had to completely change the route. And they sent it, started over the Glandon, and then they added in this new climb, the Lacette de
Montvernier.
That's right, de Montvernier, which is amazing. I luckily, 2 weeks, well, 3 or 4 weeks previous, I'd driven the family down to Italy, and we'd stopped off in the Alps, because I always like to stop off and ride up Duez. And then I went over the other mountains and rode those, and 17 switchbacks in 2.5 kilometres, which is, you know, it's crazy. I likened it to a mountain side criterium. The corners are steep. Well, many climbs the corners are shallow, but this one the corners are steep, 20%. So you push it through the corner, spin up to the next one, push it through. So you use this constant acceleration, back up acceleration, and it is exhilarating to be turning that many corners and climbing at the same time. It's a great fun, and I look forward to seeing the race go up it.
I mean, that's got to be one of the highlights, at least from the camera work point of view. I don't think they're allowing spectators on the side, are they?
It will be hard, and it's very narrow. It's like a one-way street up a mountain, and God knows how they get the caravan up there. I mean,
I don't think they'll bother sending it if there's no spectators there.
There's no spectators to grab the hats, then why send it? Even the following vehicle to the cars, it's going to be congestion, because you're stopping and starting every 200 metres. How are they going to... I'll be interested to see how they manage it. I mean, whether it does much to the race, it's a little bit of a novelty, much like things like the Mer de Hoy or the Mer de Bretagne. It's a sort of a springboard for a solo attack, but it's not going to change the race. I mean, that whole day is just a big day of climbing, which won't do anything for GC. Probably see Sagan trying to win that one.
Ending up coming second.
Yeah.
Out of the Alpine climbs that we've got, which would you recommend to an amateur cyclist to make a pilgrimage to?
Alpduez.
Has it got to be the Alpduez?
Alpduez is, I mean, again, it's not the longest, it's not the steepest, it's far from the prettiest. But if you're going to make a pilgrimage to ride one mountain, you ride Alpduez. More people have ridden that than anywhere else. And it is the quintessential. It's like the Champs-Élysées. The Tour isn't really the same without Alpduez.
How did it get that status?
There is a little story behind that. I can't remember the date, something like 58 or something. The first time they used it, Faster Coppi won up it. Now, Faster Coppi was already a legend, but this was the first time that the Tour was broadcast live on TV. So all the stars aligned. You know, the world got to see this mountain and the current biggest star in cycling, and I hope I've got my facts correct, finish up it. And then that's set its place in, you know, sort of tour history. And then he's had things like two or three Dutchmen winning, which is a generation ago now, but there's still a corner devoted to Dutch people, which is called Dutch Corner. It's sort of two thirds up the mountain where they paint the road orange. And it's like Glastonbury on the mountainside. They'll be there 2 days beforehand drinking solidly. And when the race comes through, it's chaos.
I mean, we ought to talk a little bit about the crowds in the tour, getting back to the professional side of things. I did have a question on Twitter from a listener whose name completely escapes me right now, and I haven't got Twitter fired up at the minute. So, mystery listener, thank you for your question. And the question was about whether the professional riders mind about all the crowds on the roads, particularly during the climbs, when I guess they're right in their faces. I mean, clearly in this tour we have had a nasty incident where Chris Froome was assaulted with a cup of something. It could be
Manchurian,
whatever it was.
You can't take that away from cycling, because that is the joy of it, its accessibility. I mean, it's happened in the past. This isn't the first time it's ever happened. I mean, 2012-11, when tacks were thrown on the road. There's always going to be the odd nutter out there. But if you look at how many millions and millions of people are standing at the side of the road, you know, one or two incidents, it's way below the probability of those sort of things happening.
And how do you retain your composure? I mean, I've seen you racing at the Catford Hill Climb. And if you can imagine that last bit where everyone's crowded in on the road and the road sort of part to let you through at the last bit. And that is maybe about 50 yards, isn't it? Yeah. And then we've got like 10 kilometers of that. How do you even see the road?
Well, I can't speak from their experience, but from riding hill climbs like that, where it's the throng of people and they part and you see the road and they're an extra gear. You know, the top of the Catford, they're worth an extra sprocket, because they're screaming and they're shouting. It's a deafening noise and it pulls you up. I mean, whether that's the same for the pros, I mean, you could hope it is. That constant, you know, it's almost like dragging you up the hill. I can hope that. But when you look at the top of the mountains, especially, I went up the Col di Finestra in Italy. It was 2,000 meters. Nutters don't climb a bike up to 2,000 meters to interrupt a bike race. Only the hardcore do that, and they respect every single rider. They know exactly what they're doing. If you go back to the tour in Yorkshire, I mean, that was 10 deep with people, and it was so thick with people that the race was purely a procession. Like, there was no attacking, nothing could happen. They were just squeezing through people from start to finish and then heading off to France.
I mean, that is a bit of a problem, isn't it? If it's so narrow that you can't have an attack, or do you think that the crowds would realise that something's happening and they'd step aside?
In Yorkshire, there was too many people to allow any racing to happen until that last couple of K into Sheffield.
That's an interesting thing you should say, that it was actually the crowd that shut down the racing.
Yeah, that's my opinion. That might be controversial, but from where I was standing on the side of the road and looking on TV, that's what happened.
This is where I have to relate my own very gentle dipping of the toe into the world of hill climbing, because since having gone down to see you at the Catford Hill Climb, I thought, well, you know, I should try one of these things. And then moving to Abergavenny, it turns out that our local cycling club hill climb is actually right outside my house. And it's called the Derry Dash, and it's run by David James, who's the dad of Becky James and all other James sisters. It's a good event, and I have done it for the last few years. And
A veteran.
I'm a veteran in every sense of the word. I've definitely felt that bit at the end when there's everybody there, and obviously it's not loads of people shouting, some of them. It was for me, it was not like they were encouraging me. It was a bit of that, but it was more the shame, the kind of feeling of like, I have got to be giving it everything now, because there are people watching me. And if I'm looking like I'm soft pedaling or looking up or not looking like I'm in pain, they're going to think, who is this guy? He's not trying hard. Because the thing about the hill climb that I've really got to grips with is that it is about an all-out effort. At least this is a 1 minute 35 seconds was my time. I mean, obviously it's not a fully all-out effort, but you've got to measure it a bit. But basically you want to get to the top feeling nothing. Like there's nothing there. Yeah. And that is the pleasure that you get from it. But there's also pain you've got to go through to get there. And but for me, it was like the feeling of public shame that I felt that what the potential feeling of public shame, or maybe the actual feeling of public shame as a 42-year-old man racing up a hill.
But yeah, you've put yourself on the pedestal. There's nowhere to run. You know, you can't hide from it. You've got to do it.
And I don't think I could deliver that same sort of effort on my own.
You can never replicate in training what you can do in a race. I mean, I train up hills all the time, but you can always go that bit deeper in racing. And again, they do. I think they numb the pain slightly. They take your mind off it, and they put the event in a whole different context. You're suddenly on stage, and you're part of the show, and it takes away a lot of the pain and the agony of it. And you're going to perform, and you're going to love performing. You know, there must be something narcissistic about being a pro rider and on the climbs. You know, look at me, look at what I'm doing. Maybe they're putting themselves on the stage, and they're showing the world what they can do.
So let's turn to your latest book, The Cycling Climbs of Southeast England.
Yes.
So you're going regional, as I said at the top of the show. You're now this is the first in the series of regional guides to the UK.
I went to see my publisher because I'd had a year off writing a book last year, and I was getting itchy feet. I said, right, I presented it to him, box set. So we take the climbs from each, the two British books, and then we get loads more, and we sort of make a book for each region. So if you live in the southeast, you've got everything in one place for the first time, to use some marketing speak. So it does take in all the climbs that have previously been published in 100 Greatest Cycling Climbs and another 100 Greatest Cycling Climbs, and I've made sure that each one contains at least 50% more, arguably way over 50% more new climbs. I started with the southeast because that might make everyone up the north angry. Oh, why are you always do the southeast first? Always gets the attention. Yeah, hopefully that'll work. But their books are coming just as fast as I can write them.
What's your favourite or worst climb in the southeast? I mean, I call them worst and you call them best.
Yeah.
I mean, that really does distinguish us, really, as in our approaches. I mean, I write guidebooks where I try and avoid having to send people up really steep and nasty hills and think of cunning ways to get up the sort of easy way. And whereas you send them up the hard way and take pleasure in doing that. Which is your favourite?
Well, my favourite and worst is a climb called Chalk Pit Lane out of Limpsfield.
Yeah, I know the one.
And it's a beautiful piece of road. I mean, it's a bit industrial at the bottom, but it's really steep, sweeping, smooth corner. And I loved it until, I think it was not last year, year before, when I got invited to go and do a talk at a bike shop, and then we rode out and had a little impromptu race up there. I don't think I was in the best of shape. I went far too deep on it. I caught the guy in front of me. I was clearly going to win it by a minute. But then he came back and overtook me. I'm like, wait a minute. And I had to try and overtake him again. And by the time I got to the finish, I was seeing stars. And I don't think I've been back since. So it was my favourite hill. And it does grace the cover of the book. But yeah, I've not been back since. I went to places I'd not been before to write this book. I'd had really much of the South Downs and found some fantastic hills like Buster Hill in Hampshire. And it's so quiet out there. There's no one there. So that was great. And then some of the ones down sort of left of Brighton. I'm just going to look now. Firle Beacon, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
Firle Bostel and Bo Peak Bostel, which is next to it. Great roads.
Well, you're much to be admired. They've been a huge success. And you see them everywhere, and I think the way you've brought back the pocket road book, because this is really what they are in a sense. They're a kind of reinterpretation of the pocket road book, because this is what cyclists used to have, you know, from the 1880s, 1890s, with these little tiny pocket road books. And I've got a few of them, beautifully produced volumes with a huge amount of information in them. And you've returned to that original concept. It's not all on computers.
You can download a digital version, but I like the book. I like the physical thing. Maybe in a generation's time, a relative of Marco Portillo will be taking a tatty copy around the country and like his Bradshaw's guides. And, you know, I think there's something good to be holding the physical book in your hand. And it's designed to fit in your pocket.
So they are published by Francis Lincoln and a bargain at $8.99 a piece. So look them out. Back to the tour, some predictions. I mean, I think we're pretty much agreed that Chris Froome is looking unassailable. Is there a strategy for overcoming him, or is everybody too worried about safeguarding the position that they've got in the top five or top 10?
What's the point in safeguarding your position? You know, it's going to be death or glory for all these guys now. Just, I mean, I don't think you're going to see a pact between them, but they're just going to keep hitting him. You know, let's hope he'll have a bad day. You know, will he, won't he? We don't know. I think the only person who could lose the tour for Froome is Froome, but the rest have got to try. I mean, it's easy for us to sit here on our sofas screaming at them. You know, I've ridden all these mountains. Once you're in the red, you're in the red. That's it. You're done for. You can't go any faster. So, you know, as armchair supporters, we can always say, go attack him. But they'll be on the limit. Because to follow Chris's wheel, you have to be on the limit. But I just hope we have some animation. We have some ups and downs. We've got three hilltop finishes. I mean, the first one, Prior Loop, which is Wednesday. It's a very gentle climb, that. You don't need to be a climber to get up that one. But La Tuzière, you know, that's the big stage, in my opinion, which I think is Friday. That's where the tour will be decided. Outdoors could be more of a procession. But I think if you're going to win the tour, you win up La Tuzière.
Well, that's a great prediction. We'll hold you to it, Simon. Thank you very much for joining me on The Bike Show. And all your books, I'll put a link to them from The Bike Show website. You can find them. They all got a great big triangle on the front, red triangle with a profile picture of you, that is you, in your skin suit, riding up an unfeasibly steep incline.
Doing a hill stand.
Yeah. So thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me. And enjoy the rest of the tour.
My thanks to Simon Warren for joining me for the second of the rest day reviews in this year's Tour de France. And if you're one of the legion of Bike Show listeners who doesn't care for bicycle racing, you probably haven't listened this far. But if you have, well done. Thanks for your perseverance. And we'll be back to normal, not very sporty business on the Bike Show next time. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Let me hear that tune, Billy. Warm up soon. Lifted before, so keep it up, jump on my desire, and I'll be at your side forevermore, yeah, yeah. I know your love, keep on lifting me, keep on lifting me high. I know your love, yeah, keep on lifting me, keep on lifting me high and high. Now once, I was so down, closest friend, yes it was. Then you came and it soon departed. And it ain't never dared to show its face again, no way. I know your love, keep on lifting me, keep on lifting me high. Stand up tomorrow morning and face this world in our camp. I know you love, keep on lifting me, keep on lifting me high. Hey, you love, keep on lifting me, keep on lifting me high, high, little bit higher, little bit higher. Oh, I know my one desire. desire, and I'll be at your side forevermore. Yeah, yeah. I know you'll love me. Keep on lifting me. Keep on lifting me high. Know you love me. Keep on lifting me high and higher, 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 higher. I'm so glad, baby, that I finally found you. You my one million sweet little Andrea girl. Can't stand up to my-